I have to confess that it's a bit difficult to address such a huge topic, resisting war, racism, and occupation. There's a lot to cover. I'm not going to pretend that I'm going to cover this comprehensively at all. I'm going to cover a section of it. When we talk about war, obviously in the minds of most people is the war that happened and is still happening in Iraq, the previous war in Afghanistan. We now know that at least 12,000 civilians were killed in each of those wars, and more are dying. When we talk about racism, more people are becoming familiar with the term racial profiling. And now I think more people, more than ever, are beginning to understand that racial profiling exists. We have, of course, the case that's making headlines right now of Maher Arar, the Syrian-Canadian. His case is a stunning case. And the only thing that stands out about Maher Arar's case is that he came back and is able to tell us about his story, a very credible story. And of course, when we talk about occupation, Palestine dominates headlines, the occupation in Iraq. And that's only sort of the surface of what we know. There are other fronts in the war, global war, Colombia, the Philippines. We hear not a lot about those wars and the use of American troops and American aid and American military. Layla talked about the deportation today of Ahmed Abdel Majid. Montreal is a front line in the struggles of refugee communities in fighting against racial profiling and deportations. The Non-Status Algerian Committee, Action Committee of Pakistani Refugees, and in every case you've had people who were eventually deported. And when we talk about occupation more broadly, the most primordial injustice, I think, when we are sitting here in Montreal, in the state called Canada, is the dispossession and the genocide of Indigenous people. So this is a huge, huge topic, resisting war, racism, and occupation. And sometimes I feel like it shouldn't be the term resisting, but rather surviving war, racism, and occupation. But when you look at it, surviving is resisting, and it's a first step. There are a lot of complexities, a lot of layers to all these subjects. And I always try to come to grips with these subjects by going to the basics, going to the roots, which means sometimes coming to some radical conclusions, such as the fact that we live in an era, I think it's fair to say, of neo-imperialism and neo-colonialism that mirrors former eras of imperialism and colonialism that bring us to where we are today. I'm not going to give a big discourse on colonialism or imperialism. I think perhaps the best way that I could address this topic is to talk about the analysis being developed by people who are organizing under this banner or framework called No One is Illegal or Open Borders, people who are confronting something called Fortress North America, basically looking at war not simply as something that happens elsewhere, but that's something that happens here. And war isn't simply when bombs are falling on you and missiles are being aimed into your homes, but war is something that also happens on a low-intensity level, and they both play off each other. So I want to talk about war and occupation and racism in reference to migrants and refugees, to immigrants. And I come at this out of organizing around globalization, the so-called anti-globalization movement, although it's not really anti-globalization. If globalization means, you know, sharing of cultures and what have you, it's pro-globalization, but it's opposition to capitalist-style globalization. And people often think, well, okay, you're doing globalization stuff, and here's a bunch of stuff that deals with immigrants and refugees, and it's sort of separate. While for me, my involvement and the involvement of literally hundreds and thousands of people all over North America and movements for the defense of immigrants and refugees flows out of and is integral as part of a globalization movement. As well, many of us, despite the lowering of energy, I think, around mobilizing against war, many of us were part of this anti-war movement. Many of us have to be because there were 250,000 people on the streets of Montreal, so they came from somewhere. And often, it's often thought of that, okay, you have the issue about war and happening in Iraq or in Palestine or in Afghanistan, and then there's the immigrant refugee issues. And again, I think the analysis I'm going to put forward to you flows out of mobilizing against war and is actually integral to understanding the current climate of war, current climate of racism, the current climate of occupation. I want to validate two concepts, both of which have been brought up already by both Helga and by Layla. The first is the concept of apartheid. Helga has mentioned it in reference to the separation fence or the apartheid wall, the way in which we have a different set of values and different set of rights for different groups of people. And I want to expand that concept of apartheid by looking at this issue of migration. And secondly, we can talk about colonialism, we can talk about neocolonialism, imperialism, neo-imperialism. We can make jokes for hours and hours about George Bush and his intelligence and what have you. But I think a very important term to understand as well when we're dealing with these issues is the idea of self-determination. And self-determination, not simply of collectivities, although that's the way we commonly understand it, self-determination of the right to self-determination of Palestinians, of native peoples, etc., but also what self-determination means to each and every one of us as individuals. The idea that we want to have some basic control over our lives, that we want to have choices. I think that's what ultimately motivates us. That's what stands and lurks behind the battles for justice and dignity, whatever they might be. So I want to apply all of those ideas, looking at the idea of migration and the reality of migration, which I think is something that isn't part of a mainstream discourse anymore, like talking about the war is, or like talking about free trade is. And I think it should be, because it is something that literally affects millions and millions of people directly, and if we believe what happens to others affects us, it affects all of us. So perhaps one way to start is just acknowledging that reality of migration. The fact that, according to the United Nations, 175 million people are crossing borders, national borders, every year permanently. 175 million people. And that's double what it was a decade ago, and it's expected to double again in another decade. This is an unprecedented movement of human beings ever in human history. The numbers, this 175 million every year, expected to double in another 10 years, the numbers really don't do justice to the stories that lurk behind each and every one of those 175 million people. We can talk, for example, about the tragedies that occur when people are making these extraordinary voyages and journeys. For example, there was a ferry between Indonesia and Australia back in October of 2001, a ferry that was crammed with people from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from Algeria, and from Palestine. And I don't have to condescend to you and explain to you why people from those four areas of the world might be on ferries trying to go elsewhere in the world. And they were on this ferry between Indonesia and Australia. And it was so crammed that the ferry cracked in two, and 350 people, including 100 children, drowned to death at sea. That was back in October of 2002. But these are tragedies that are more common than we think. About a month ago, there was a report of a boat between Tunisia and Italy that capsized and resulted in the drowning of about a dozen people. And we can go on and on. One story that I remember quite vividly is the story of a container between Britain and France, trying to get into Britain from France, a container that contained Chinese migrants who suffocated to death. And when I read this story, a detail that stood out was the description of the imprints in the metal of the fists of the migrants as they were trying to punch their way out or trying to create enough noise to get out. And they suffocated to death in that container. And again, this is more common than we think. It's a daily reality of people dying, making these journeys. And beyond the tragedies, of course, are the risks involved. Obviously, there are risks involved. People who are willing to go into containers and the backs of trucks, pay shady people money to move them from one place to another, cram onto ferries. Just one statistic, between the U.S.-Mexican border, in the last 10 years, 2,000 people have been killed making that journey from Mexico into the U.S. They've been killed either by vigilantes or by exposure or by dehydration. And of course, the consequences at the end of those journeys aren't all that great either. We're talking about refugee camps. We're talking about detention centers. We're talking about people who are living clandestine, unstable lives. These aren't realities that are somewhere else. They're existing right here in our own communities. The deportation today of Ahmed Abdelmajid is an example of that, of somebody who had to live one of those clandestine, unstable lives, somebody who's stateless to begin with. So I think this is a starting point, understanding this reality, unprecedented, this movement, the stories behind it. And I can't even begin to, in the time that I have, to like do justice to what those stories mean. But this migration isn't a 10 minutes. Okay, this migration isn't an arbitrary thing. People just moving from, you know, across borders here to there. This is a migration that has a pattern. It's a migration of people from southern countries to northern countries. People from former colonized nations to the nations that did the colonizing, or the settler nations. People from Latin America, from Asia, from Africa, to places in North America and Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and even now in this new era of neocolonialism, even to the rich Arab states and to Israel. Israel actually has the second highest number of foreign workers next to Switzerland. This is a reflection of global apartheid, whereby if you're lucky enough, and believe me, it has nothing to do with how smart you are, if you're lucky enough to have a passport from one of these destination countries, a country in North America, in Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, you have certain rights, you have certain mobility, you have certain opportunity. And I don't want to underplay the problems, the very real problems that exist in each and every one of those countries, but you do have certain mobility. And if you don't have one of those passports, you're going to be highly, highly motivated to get one. You're going to take those risks to get one. This is a reflection of this global apartheid that I talked about. And I guess before looking into why this global apartheid exists, we have to sort of ask ourselves, well, why is this movement happening? Is this sort of just a sudden mass curiosity by brown and yellow and black people to tear themselves away from their homelands and the people they know and the communities that they understand and are comfortable in, and to go on these incredible journeys elsewhere? Well, of course, the reasons why people are moving today in unprecedented numbers are the same reasons they moved 100 years ago or 200 years ago. It has to do with something that I call displacement and the reasons for displacement. Some of those reasons are that rural communities and economies are destroyed, growing unemployment worldwide, growing poverty worldwide, war and militarization. That's one of the main factors for why people move and need to move. The forced eviction of people from their land, the Palestinian issue is an example of that. These are the reasons why people are moving. So it's not simply people who are, you know, bogus migrants who just want to make more money elsewhere. It really has to do with underdevelopment and persecution of people worldwide. And while in one era, for example, the era when people from Ireland or Scotland or England or Germany or places in Scandinavia, when they came here for very much the same reasons, the destruction of rural economies, the movement of people away from the commons into big cities, when they came here, they're now celebrated. We name universities and streets and all kinds of things after them. But when others, for example, who are facing the same reality, say Chinese migrants in provinces like Fujian or Sichuan, where there's a high degree of industrialization going and the same dynamic is happening, when they come here, they're dismissed as bogus refugees, as queue jumpers, etc. There's a real double standard there. And I guess one thing to understand is that exactly the same time that this unprecedented level of movement is happening of people, there's unprecedented barriers going up to people. And those barriers, of course, are going up in the destination countries, in the US, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, in Western Europe. And they have names for these barriers. In Europe, while Jacques Chirac and Tony Blair disagreed about going to war with Iraq, Jacques Chirac didn't want to go to war because that would be good for French oil companies, and Tony Blair wanted to go to war because that would be good for British oil companies, and they had that very principled disagreement over going to war with Iraq. While they disagreed over that, they agreed on the creation of something called Fortress Europe, a whole set of policies to deal with migration into Europe. In North America, Tom Ridge, the U.S. Director of Homeland Security, John Manley, who was Kretchen's designate to deal with border issues, they came up with this concept of Fortress North America. In Australia and New Zealand, they don't use the term fortress. They use the term, and I'm not making this up, they use the term the Pacific Solution. And you have to ask yourself, a fortress against who? A solution against who? And when you look at the color of migration, you begin to see the racist dimension to all of this. And the other thing that stands out is that the very same countries that are putting up these fortresses, that are talking about solutions, are the same ones that congratulate themselves for their openness towards immigrants and migrants and refugees, because of course there are immigrants and migrants to those countries. When the reality is that 70% of people, 70% of that 175 million moving every year, 70% of those people end up migrating in the end to another third world country. The millions of people who were displaced from Afghanistan over the 1980s and 90s weren't airlifted into Great Britain or Canada or the US. They're living in refugee camps in Iran or in Pakistan. Those are the countries that are welcoming those refugees. The journeys those people have undertaken are incredible. And we again congratulate ourselves for our openness, but you know, to walk for hundreds of miles from a region in Afghanistan to get to a refugee camp in Pakistan means incredible acts of solidarity and hospitality made by people on both sides of the border that have nothing, that have nothing. So just to go on, because I'm running out of time and I don't think I'll be able to cover everything I wanted to. I just want to say that in reality, these policies of Fortress North America, and just quickly, some of those policies are Bill C-11, which has meant more detention, limited appeals, the banning of certain people from sponsoring migrants, Safe Third Country Agreement, which allows the immediate deportation of anybody who comes here through the U.S., the so-called smart border that was introduced and signed between Canada and the U.S., the smart border equation being that you take dumb border officials on one side, and you add them to dumb border officials on the other, and lo and behold, you have your smart border. The smart border, in reality, is simply the militarization of the Canada-U.S. border. The targeting and registering and fingerprinting and photographing of certain people who are being racially profiled. The creation of a Northern Command, which is the new military command to deal with this part of the world. Those are some of the things that constitute Fortress North America. Not to mention that the immigration refugee system as it existed before was already structurally flawed. We have a point system, for example, to come to Canada as an immigrant. And under that point system, you literally have to be Superman or Superwoman to qualify. That's how high the points have become. Just to give one example, if you were to take a cross-section of famous Canadians, and this study has been done before, only Margaret Atwood and Pierre Burton would qualify under the point system, and everyone else would have to go. Another way to look at it, though, is that you look at a city like Montreal or Toronto or Vancouver or Ottawa even, and we know that there's a whole generation of people that came here in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. They constitute the fabric of this city. They're just taken for granted. Those people who came in the 60s and 70s, if they were to abide by this current point system, wouldn't be able to get in. My parents, my mother and my father, wouldn't have been able to get in under this new point system. But this new Fortress North America, to be clear, is not necessarily meant to keep people out, because people are getting in. And if you actually look at our economy, and you look at who's pumping gas at gas stations, who's working in the backs of kitchens and fast food restaurants, who's working in agricultural fields, who's working in sweatshops, all those sort of one-story factories that surround airports and what have you. If you're looking at who works in construction, who's working as minimum wage labor in hotels, doing service jobs, you begin to see the color of labor, and you begin to see what this migration is and what underpins these economies. Countries like Canada and the U.S., especially the U.S., their economies would fall apart if all the illegals and all the non-status people were thrown out immediately. California, for example, has literally millions and millions of people who are doing this illegal labor that underpins their economy. So if you have Fortress North America, but you know people are getting in, what is Fortress North America doing? Well, what it does is it lessens the ability of people to claim full rights. It forces them to be more less outspoken, less willing to claim their rights as workers or as potential citizens. It makes them that much more exploitable, which is what this economy is based on. It's a great example of how globalization and the new security laws fit together to exploit people. I'm running out of time, but I want to just address, maybe ground ourselves in a bit of history, and then I'll conclude. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to deal with a lot of what I wanted to deal with, but anyways, we have to leave time for questions. I think it's important that we ground ourselves in history when we're looking at migration. And I'm not going to go back like hundreds of years. I'll just limit myself to Canada in, say, the 1900s. We used to have a head tax, for example, against Chinese migrants to this country. We had a de facto whites-only immigration policy up until the 1950s. The worst riots in Canadian history weren't at Concordia. They weren't at a Stanley Cup celebration. They weren't at a globalization protest. The worst riots in Canadian history were in 1907 in Vancouver against Chinese and Japanese Canadians whose property was attacked, and many of whom were killed during those riots in 1907. Skipping ahead to the Second World War, Jewish refugees, one of the classic definition of a refugee, Jewish refugees fleeing Nazi-occupied Europe were not let into Canada under a policy at the time that was called none is too many. That was the articulated policy of the Canadian government at the time vis-a-vis Jewish refugees. None is too many. We have the internment of the Japanese, and we can go on and on. And for each case that I've just mentioned, these riots, the head tax, de facto whites-only immigration policy, the none is too many policy against Jewish migrants, the internment of the Japanese, in one way or another, the Canadian state has either apologized or reckoned with it, one way or another, not to the full pleasure of the people who are fighting on these issues, but in one way or another, we acknowledge that these things are wrong, and we're not repeating the mistakes of the past, and we should learn from them. Well, I just want to give some examples of how each and every one of these mistakes are being repeated. The head tax against Chinese migrants. Well, today, we don't have a head tax against Chinese migrants, but if you're a refugee, and you want to make a humanitarian and compassionate grounds claim to stay in this country, you have to pay $550 per head. The whole point of that $550 fee is to prevent you from making that claim. Because, of course, if you're a refugee, you can't afford to make that kind of claim. I talked about the none is too many policy against Jewish migrants, the safe third country policy, whereby if you come through the U.S. and about 40% of refugees do so, you're immediately deported. That policy has been described by refugee advocates as a none is too many policy, of not even looking at the claim and simply sending them back. I talked about the internment of the Japanese. Now, we don't intern Arabs and Muslims, as a lot of right-wing commentators are reminding us. We haven't interned them en masse, and somehow we should congratulate ourselves for our openness and our liberalness in dealing with the current climate of terrorism. Well, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people rounded up post-September 11th, only about under 1% of whom had any link whatsoever to terrorism, and they were detained. But not only that, you have now in process, and this is something Maher Arar had to deal with when he was eventually sent back to Syria, a policy called registration in the United States, something that Canada is complicit in, whereby if you come from a list of 25 countries, whether you're a permanent resident or not, if you come from a list of 25 countries in the U.S., all of whom are Arab or Muslim, except for North Korea, you have to register. You have to go into the INS office and provide fingerprints, provide photographs, tell them where you live, what's going on in your life, people you're dealing with, and if you don't go in, you're subject to deportation or imprisonment. Now, technologies develop, people get more subtle, and I fully believe that forcing literally millions of people, and that's how many people are being forced to register in the U.S., forcing millions of people to register is the modern-day equivalent of interning them as we did in the Second World War. It's the modern-day equivalent of keeping people under control, forcing them to be chilled in their communities. And you can imagine the chill effect right now in Arab communities when Maher Arar, whose only crime apparently was to know the wrong person, who, by the way, is now detained as well. We know nothing about him. That was his only crime. You can imagine the chill that creates in communities, the chill that creates in people being outspoken and speaking out and taking stands on a variety of issues. Now, I've gone over my time, so I have to conclude, and I will. And I'll say this to me is a reflection of collective punishment. And by collective punishment, what I mean is that if you're from a certain culture, and in the current environment, that is if you're Muslim or Arab, you're forced to answer for everybody else in your culture. You're forced to answer for everybody else. And you can imagine if you applied that logic to another situation. So say, for example, every white male between 20 and 30 who likes football and guns and what have you, imagine if they were forced to answer for what Timothy McVeigh did at the Oklahoma City bombing. Imagine if they had to go in and register and provide their fingerprints and photographs because, you never know, just in case, because, you fit the profile. Well, like I said, a lot of those guys have guns, and you'd have a civil war in the U.S. if you were going to tell every white, red-blooded American male to go in and register. You'd have a civil war on your hands. Imagine if every Quebecer is forced to answer for Moms Boucher, the head of the Hells Angels. It's ludicrous. We're not forced to answer for them. We're forced to answer for what we do, for our actions as individuals, for those acts. And yet what we have now is a context where we're practicing that form of collective punishment. And yet, and this is my conclusion, and yet you do have people who are in the face of this collective punishment, in the face of this racial profiling, in the face of Fortress North America, are practicing astounding acts of self-determination. And what I mean by self-determination, as I alluded to earlier, is people taking some control over their lives and trying to make something for themselves. And what's insidious is that people who practice self-determination are often being made to feel ashamed for their acts of self-determination. For someone like Ahmed Abdul Majid to come to Canada from a refugee camp, to undertake that journey, to get the false documents, to live underground, that's a profound act of self-determination. And yet he's sitting in an INS cell. He's been meant to feel ashamed for who he is. And I guess my point here when we're talking about resisting war, racism, and occupation is that what these stories, the story of Maher Arar, Abdul Majid, and others, what they demand of us is our basic solidarity with their struggles.